This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Hamm, stars as Don Draper in the AMC series Mad Men, about the professional and private lives of people in an advertising agency in the 1960s. For 3 years in a row, the show has won an Emmy for Outstanding Drama Series, and Hamm has been nominated as Outstanding Actor in a Drama Series. Don Draper epitomizes the creative, troubled, handsome, sexist, cigarette-smoking, liquor-drinking man of the 60s. But this season, his life has really gone off the rails. We'll talk about that a little later. Beginning tomorrow, you can see John Hamm in the new film The Town, which was directed by Ben Affleck, who also stars in the film. It premiered last weekend at the Toronto Film Festival. Affleck plays the leader of a crew of bank robbers from a working-class Boston neighborhood. At the start of The Town, they rob a bank and take as their hostage a bank manager played by Rebecca Hall. The robbers are masked, and they blindfolded her, so she doesn't recognize Affleck when he keeps tabs on her to make sure she's not talking to the police. They soon fall in love. John Hamm plays the lead FBI agent investigating the armed bank robbery. In this scene, he's questioning Affleck.
You and your boys didn't just roll a Star Market over in Malden for a box of quarters. No, you decided to bang it out in the North End at 9 o'clock in the morning with assault rifles. You dummies shot a guard. Now you're like a half-off sale at Big and Tall. Every cop is in line. Fortunately, though, for you, this guard has miraculously clung to life. Now, if it were up to me, and they gave me 2 minutes and a wet towel, I would personally asphyxiate this half-wit so we could string you up on a federal M1 and end this story with a bag on your head and a paralyzing agent running through your veins. But I did want to say one thing. You're here today so I could personally tell you that you are going to die in federal prison. And so are all your friends. No deal. No compromise.
That's my guest, John Hamm, with Ben Affleck in a scene from the new film, The Town. John Hamm, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is really wonderful to have you here. Since you were playing an FBI agent, you had an FBI consultant to work with. Was that helpful? What did you get from that?
It's tremendously helpful. We had a consultant on set at all times to sort of make sure everything was as authentic as possible. But more to the point, before we even started shooting, I was able to hang out with quite a few of the law enforcement agents in Boston, and in particular the Violent Crimes and Robbery Task Force that handles bank robberies and violent crimes at the federal level is actually made up of a sort of consortium of federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies, and they work very closely together. And because of that, they're able to use sort of the local knowledge that that the Boston Police Department has of these neighborhoods and of these criminals and of these sort of gangs, these crews that go and knock off armored cars and banks, and then they can pursue them at the federal level as well, and use the vast power of the federal law enforcement system to sort of bring these guys to justice. And they're very, very good at their job.
So I read that the FBI consultant who worked with you on the set had actually arrested some of the extras who were used in the movie, who were actual ex-cons. So did the FBI agent and the ex-cons have any direct contact that you witnessed?
Sure. It was always a strange day when the two sides would meet. And there were quite a few. We had a few of our guys in our crew that couldn't go to certain locations because it would violate their parole. So that was part of a very conscious decision on Ben's part to hire local guys and to hire guys with specific knowledge of certain neighborhoods in Boston. And sometimes you get some of the elements that come with that are sometimes some of the more unsavory elements in the world. But they were all on their best behavior, and we certainly had no shortage.
You're saying nobody robbed you?
No, nobody robbed us. So that was very fortunate.
So did any of the ex-cons or the FBI consultant at any point say to you, you're doing it wrong, it's like this?
I didn't have a sort of gotcha moment on set, really, at any point. But I was able to really handle the weapons a lot and get very comfortable with all that. And that's the biggest obstacle in any of all that is just not looking like an idiot when you're running around and holding the gun the wrong way.
Was this your first role with a gun?
No, I'd played a soldier in a movie called We Were Soldiers, quite some time ago. So I grew up around guns, and I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, and most of my family were hunters and fishermen and whatnot, and so I was relatively comfortable around guns. But still, there's a very specific technical knowledge that you have to have, and all the guys on the other side as well. You know, Jeremy and Ben and Owen and Slane, all those guys had to be very comfortable with their weapons too, because these are tools to them. They should look like they're very comfortable.
So how'd you get the part in The Town?
I had read a very early version of this script quite some time ago. I think it was probably between seasons 1 and 2 of Mad Men. And another director was attached, and I think a few other actors were sort of circling it, and they were looking at me for the part that Jeremy Renner actually ended up playing, the Jem role. And I didn't really respond to that, but in reading the script, I was like, well, I'd rather play the cop. That one seems to be a little more for me. But it ended up going away and falling apart, and the studio couldn't come to terms with the director involved, and the budget got too big, and all of this other stuff started happening. And like movies do, it fell apart. And a couple years later, maybe a year later, I was talking to someone from Warner Brothers, and they said, have you read this script, The Town? And I said, yeah, I read it. I thought it fell apart. They said, no. We're really looking at it again, and we're going back at it. Ben Affleck is going to direct it, and he's going to rewrite it, and he's going to star in it. And I had seen Gone Baby Gone and was really blown away by that as a film. And I obviously was familiar with his work as an actor and very much familiar with his work as a writer. And thought, well, that's way more intriguing. I'd love to read his version of the script. And they said, well, we'll get it to you in a couple of weeks. He's got a draft due on such and so date. And I read it, and it was tremendously different. The movie had gotten much more spare. And I think part of that was budgetary considerations, but I think also the majority of it was because Ben wanted to make this kind of throwback action film that's very bare bones and kind of lo-fi. And he did that from the script level all the way through principal photography and editing and everything else. He made a very stripped-down, classic kind of action film.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Hamm, and he plays an FBI agent in the new movie The Town, which was directed by Ben Affleck, who also stars in it. Can we talk about Mad Men? I love that show. And I know so many people who love that show. And this has been such a transformative season for your character, Don Draper. To demonstrate that, I'd like to just play a couple of short clips. So you start off season one, you're this like creative advertising genius, and you create ads that reach into people's deepest desires and motivations. In this scene from the first season, you're running an ad meeting for an ad campaign for a new aerosol deodorant. The staff has pitched you an idea comparing this new aerosol to space travel, and then you think, no, that's all wrong. We're heading in the wrong direction. And here's what you have to say.
Brass tacks, who buys this? Some woman. Your girl or your mother will pick this up walking through the grocery store or the druggist. We should be asking ourselves, what do women want?
I don't know, but I wish I had it.
Maybe a chesty alien girl also wants to get into a suit.
I'm not asking what do women want in some bullshit research psychology way. I'm asking, what would make a woman look at this man's deodorant and say, I want that?
Well, I've stopped trying to figure out what they think.
Maybe I should stop paying you.
Well, I always thought women liked the way we smell.
That explains a lot.
I feel like we're close here. I mean, this one, the can's right side up, but the guy's upside down.
No. Let's bring it down to earth. You think they want a cowboy? He's quiet and strong. He always brings the cattle home safe. You watch TV. What if they want something else? Inside some mysterious wish that we're ignoring.
Okay, so that's Don Draper, played by my guest John Hamm, in season one of Mad Men. And let's get to this season. Now, this season, it's been a rough season. Don Draper has become an out-and-out alcoholic. And
well, a less functioning alcoholic.
A less functioning alcoholic, exactly. And you've been blowing it at pitch meetings. And here's an example. You've just won a Clio, which is, you know, an Oscar in the ad world. It's like the Academy Award of the Academy Award of the ad world. And this is for a commercial you did for Glow Coat Floor Wax. And then in the after party, you've gotten drunk. And then you're holding a meeting with the people from Life Breakfast Cereal because their plane was late, so you couldn't hold the meeting earlier.
We thought the meeting was going to be canceled because their plane was grounded, but it turns out they made it through, and this unexpected meeting happened.
So you're drunk at this meeting. You've pitched them an idea which they've rejected. And then, uncharacteristically, after they reject this idea, you just kind of like start spinning out one idea after another. Here's the scene.
How about life is just a bowl of life cereal? Life is sweet. Enjoy the rest of your life. Cereal.
Don, they're not expecting you to do this right now.
Give me a second. Life, the reason to get out of bed in the morning. Life, the cure for the common breakfast. Life, its sweetness never ends. Life, eat it by the bowlful.
Oh, there you go. Cure for the common breakfast. Love it.
It's got the health angle. Life makes you feel better. It's got protein. Very nice.
That dog will hunt. Wonderful. We'll get that put together for you.
It's my guest, John Hamm, in a scene from this season of Mad Men. And what makes Don Draper's behavior even worse in that scene is that the slogan that the clients from Life Cereal like best is one that Draper actually lifted from the portfolio of a job candidate. And he's so drunk he doesn't even realize he did that.
Unconsciously.
Yeah. So John Hamm, did you have to rethink your whole portrayal this season of who Don Draper is? And this season starts with a journalist saying to Don Draper, who is Don Draper? And the whole season has been basically asking that question.
I think yes and no. I think the character has and is evolving. And certainly circumstances in Don Draper's life have changed. Don's getting older. The country is moving through a significant period of change.
His wife has left him. She's remarried. He's living alone in Greenwich Village. Even he's propositioned, well, he slept with his secretary, which was a terrible thing to do, and then kind of ditches her and fires her.
She resigns.
She resigns. Okay. Who would stay under those circumstances? And then also, I mean, even you've even lost your touch with women. I mean, things are kind of getting back to an even keel, but like you've propositioned women who've turned you down, it's kind of rough.
Well, I think this character is evolving, and what is happening is, in my opinion, and I think Matt Weiner, the show's creator, would agree with me, is that Don is sort of losing touch with not only his life but with the world around him. And as the world is changing, as he is getting older, as his circumstances are shifting, the old paradigms aren't working so much anymore. And what we found out about Mr. Draper is that he is sort of infinitely adaptable. So whether or not he pulls out of this particular funk, we'll see. But it definitely is a season about redefining who you are. When all of that stuff gets stripped away, when you no longer have the perfect wife and the perfect family and the perfect job and the perfect approach to every problem, when all of that stuff gets stripped away, who are you at the foundation? And I think that's what. And as we know about Don Draper, he's not honest with himself about. I mean, not, he is with himself, but with the world about who he is at his foundation. He is a completely constructed character.
He stole the identity of somebody.
He stole
the name
of somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's, you know, his fundamental dishonesty needs to be addressed before any sort of real growth can happen, and it remains to be seen if he's strong enough to do that.
There was recently on Mad Men a real turning point scene. It's the scene where you basically reach bottom, you bottom out, and it's after this scene that you realize something has to change in your life, and you try to start cutting back on the alcohol. But this is a scene where you've gotten so drunk. after someone who was very important to you has died, that Peggy, one of the women you work with, basically has to drag you into the restroom where you're kneeling in front of the toilet and just heaving and heaving. And when you come out of it, there's even like a yellow puke stain on your shirt. And so it's like we are seeing it, you at your lowest. And everybody who has just thought of Don Draper as this, like, you know, handsome guy and everything, we're seeing the consequences of all of Don Draper's actions play out. And I'm just wondering what it was like for you to shoot that scene where he is at his lowest.
It was a tremendously kind of exciting and cathartic and sad and wonderful scene to film. And, you know, Matt, very early on in the series, states...
This is Matt Weiner, the creator.
Matt Weiner, yes, sorry, the writer and creator, executive producer of the show, stated very on that one of the driving principles of the show is that actions have consequences. And I think some of the early criticism of the show is like, well, these actions don't have consequences. Like, this guy gets away with everything. He's a liar. He cheats on his wife. Nothing ever happens, blah, blah, blah. And what we're now finding out is, well, they don't necessarily have to have consequences on the same day or in the same episode or in the same hour of television, but they will have consequences. And we are seeing the consequences of three seasons of behavior kind of come to a head in this particular episode.
At what point did you find out that your character, Don Draper, was going to undergo this transformational change and that the consequences would catch up with him this season?
Well, I trusted in Matt to tell the story the way he wanted to tell the story and to be honest about it. And again, as I said, very early on, he said actions will have consequences. So I imagined that this would come about at some point. We don't really talk in specifics about how the show is going to progress episode to episode and season-long arcs. So, and we're not really allowed in the writer's room to go sort of peek and see where our people are going and what's going to happen. And I honestly don't really don't like knowing like what's going to come down the pike for fear of somehow subconsciously playing the end of the story or playing information that my character shouldn't have. That said, Matt and I sit at the beginning of every season and we talk about what the season is going to bring and what the arc of the season could be or should be or might be. But this is well before anything is written, and we talk in very, very general terms and themes and feelings and ideas.
Now, you auditioned for the part of Don Draper 6 times, at least that's what I read. So when you were doing the audition, you had to portray a Don Draper confidence. But because you hadn't landed a really big role before, you were probably, as many actors are, insecure at the time of the audition. You were still a waiter, weren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you probably didn't have quite the confidence that you had to convey, or maybe you did, but I'm wondering how confidence came into play during the audition.
Well, you have to, as any actor, you have to, and this is successful, unsuccessful, working, non-working, you have to portray a sense of confidence, and if you have to manufacture it, if you have to fake it, if you have to drum it up from somewhere in your subconscious, you have to do it. So I was, and I had worked as an actor, and was on a television show, and had a lot of experience. So I wasn't coming in fresh off the turnip truck, so to speak. But auditioning is a terrifying process, and it's a really soul-crushing process sometimes, because essentially what people are saying is not necessarily that we don't like your acting, but we don't like you. And that's hard to take. I really wanted to do this part, and I really felt a relationship to it.
Why? Why did you feel a relationship to it?
I've said it in other interviews, but this character very much reminded me of my father. And my dad would have been 27 years old in 1960 when we start the show. So he would have been a little younger than Don Draper, but he was a very powerful businessman, you know, in St. Louis, Missouri, where I grew up, and had a lot of friends and knew a lot of people and had a lot of power and had a lot of connections, and was a pretty sad guy. Not because he subsumed somebody's identity and had a basic, you know, fundamental lie that he was living. But he, you know, my father was twice widowed and had a tough time. And so it was interesting. It just resonated for me in that respect. So I really wanted to do it, and I thought the writing was excellent, as has been borne out. And I wanted to make the best of the opportunity. So I feel like I did represent confidence walking into the room, and the next seven times I had to walk into the room, I tried to be as confident as I could coming back.
You were very funny in 30 Rock, playing a doctor who was dating Tina Fey. And because you're so handsome, when you go to a restaurant together, women send over drinks and the waitress gives you free food. The mayor comes over and wants to dance with you. And Alec Baldwin explains to Tina Fey that this is because beautiful people are treated differently than moderately plain-looking people. They live in a bubble, and the bubble is a world of free drinks, kindness, and outdoor sex. So I want to play a scene after Alec Baldwin explains that. And you and Tina Fey are in a restaurant, and you want to order something off the menu. And Tina Fey says, no, I'm going to order for you. And she covers your face with a menu so that the waitress can't see how handsome you are. And then she orders. Here's the scene.
Let me order that for you. Excuse me. We will have a turkey burger deluxe and a catfish po' boy with a diet raspberry Fanta.
I'm going to come back in 5 minutes. You try to order off the menu again, I will smack those glasses off your face.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
What was that? Why didn't she call you sweetheart? And where's the complimentary app sampler? What's going on?
Okay, Drew, this is how most people live. See, because of your whole, you know, Disney Prince thing.
Actually, they used footage of me from my high school swim team to draw Prince Eric.
Right. Because of that, you live in a bubble where people do what you want and tell you what you want to hear.
Oh, I don't think that's true.
Drew, I'm going to tell you this for your own good. You can't put Gatorade on salmon.
Oh, yes, you can. The hot Italian lady from the Food Network told me so.
Did she say it on TV?
No, she said it to me when she jumped escalators to try to talk. Oh. Well, I don't want to live that way. I don't want you to treat me that way.
Are you sure?
Yeah, Liz, I'm an adult. You can be honest with me. I can take it.
Well, you can't really take it, as it turns out. So do you ever feel like you live in that bubble, the bubble of beautiful people?
I certainly don't. I don't consider myself some sort of beautiful person by any stretch of the imagination. But I do think that our culture sort of does that in a certain sense with celebrities in some capacity. It is, I think that is the larger point of that whole storyline is a comment on that, how our culture is sort of obsessed with the beautiful people and treating them just so, because you desperately want to be part of that group. I don't feel that way. I have enough self-loathing and cynicism in me to autocorrect at any particular time.
So you're very funny at satirizing, you know, Don Draper and perceptions of you. You hosted Saturday Night Live a couple of times, and on one of those episodes, you did a sketch called Don Draper's Guide to Picking Up Women. And I just want to play some of that.
And now, Don Draper's Guide to Picking Up Women.
Hello, I'm Don Draper, and I've been fortunate enough to have affairs with many women. Some say, boy, Don, how do you do it? Well, it's simple. And you can do it, too, if you follow my four easy steps. Step one, when in doubt, remain absolutely silent.
Hi, I'm Jessica. A little shy, aren't we? Marry me, I want to have your children.
See? Step two, when asked about your past, give vague, open-ended answers.
So, Don, tell me about your family. Any brothers and sisters?
There was a man with bright, shiny shoes. I saw him dancing until the accident.
How mysterious.
Step three, have a great name.
Hi, I'm Nathaniel Snurpus.
Well, hello.
Don Draper.
Let's get me out of this skirt.
And finally, step four. Look fantastic in a suit. Look fantastic in casual wear. Look fantastic in anything. Sound good. Smell good. Kiss good. Strut around with supreme confidence. Be uncannily successful at your job. Blow people away every time you say anything. Take six-hour lunches. Disappear for weeks at a time. Lie to everyone about everything. And drink and smoke constantly. Basically, be Don Draper.
This has been Don Draper's Guide to Picking Up Women.
It's my guest, John Hamm, on Saturday Night Live. Who wrote that sketch?
I don't know who wrote that one. I'm not sure, honestly. The interesting thing about that, and I haven't heard that clip in quite some time, is that you can hear Matt Weiner laughing in the crowd reactions. He has a very particular
Seriously?
Laugh.
Really?
Yes.
He was in the audience?
He was in the audience that night. That was the first time I hosted, and quite a few of our cast and crew were in attendance. And I could pick it out. I could hear it. It's very funny.
Were you confident in your dating years?
Not particularly. I was sort of a late bloomer and was not really necessarily one of the cool kids and not really. I mean, I was just kind of like the sort of weird kid that didn't do much of anything, actually.
No,
that should be enough to show you how awkward I was when I was dating. I can't even talk about it.
Now, earlier in our interview, you said that the portrayal of Don Draper is based in part on your father, who was a businessman who was very powerful and important in, was it St. Louis where you grew up?
St. Louis, Missouri, yeah.
Yeah. So what kind of business was it?
Trucking, actually. Trucking and heavy hauling. And it was a family business, three or four generations before me. And started with a block and tackle and a horse and wagon pulling stuff up off the Mississippi, off the barges off the Mississippi and loading it onto wagons and carts and heading it out west. That turned into, you know, over-the-road 18-wheeler rigging and block and tackle for railroads and stuff. And in the 60s was kind of the height of over-the-road trucking and interstate commerce. And obviously my dad had to deal with a lot with the unions and the Teamsters So there was a lot going on, and he was kind of right at the center of it.
Go ahead. No, you.
What ended up happening was, you know, container ships and shipping, overseas shipping actually ended up overtaking over-the-road truck and heavy hauling. So the business sort of dried up, and then as happens, it sort of they started to conglomerate, and we ended up getting bought out, I think, in the early 80s. And then that was the end of that.
Awkward to bring this up, but did he have to deal with the mob also?
There were definitely elements of that, obviously, when you're talking about, trucking and Teamsters and that kind of thing. There was. At my dad's funeral, there were a few guys with pinky rings, to say the least.
So in our previous interview, you said that your father was a salesman who could sell anything to anybody. So it sounds like he wasn't literally a salesman.
Well, by that, you know, like I said, he had sold the business in the early 80s. And after that, he would have been 47 years old in 1980, so he had plenty of career left to do. So he sold cars, he sold trucks, and he hustled, you know. He had a kid to take care of, so he had to make money somehow.
Earlier you described your father as a very successful businessman, but also very sad.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mean depression or?
Well, he had a sad life in a lot of ways. His first wife.
Your mother?
No.
No?
His first wife. My mother was his second wife. His first wife he had two daughters with, and she died of a brain aneurysm very suddenly. And very tragically, leaving him to sort of take care of these two little girls. And that was difficult for him. He then met and married my mother around about 1969, I suppose, who was much younger than he was, and had me in 1971, and then got divorced. And my mother was out of that relationship pretty quick. So then had, you know, three kids and no wife, and was ended up sort of back home living with his mom. And And then when my mother passed away when I was 10, I then had to move back in with my dad and my grandmother, his mother. So, yeah, he was a sad guy. You know, he had a lot of, I think he probably had a lot of regret in his life. And, yeah, it was the best way I could describe it is that it was a tricky situation.
Were you close at all with your father before your mother died? Had you been seeing him much when you were living with your mother after your parents separated?
Yeah, it was you know, shared custody. So it was a, you know, sort of a every other weekend or something like that. Not dissimilar to the Draper children. But yeah, I loved my dad. I loved spending time with him. And you know, you're a little kid. You don't really understand what happens in between adults and adult relationships. You just think like, well, why aren't you guys together? You know, you used to be together. Why aren't you anymore? And the sort of vagaries of adult relationships are lost on little kids. So yeah, I didn't really get it. And you know, by the time I was old enough to understand that stuff, both of them had passed away. So that's kind of lost to the sands of time, I suppose.
Your father died when you were about 20?
20 years old, yeah.
Was the sadness that you said he had, was that kind of contagious?
To me?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, again, that's his sadness was sort of a world weariness and a product of life choices and all that kind of stuff. Whereas I was a little kid, you know, you're a teenager or I guess the preferred term these days is tween. You know, sort of adolescent, you got your whole life ahead of you and you think you're bulletproof and you're excited to get up in the morning and go to school and play football and play baseball and do all that stuff. So I was a pretty happy kid.
So you were 10 when your mother died. Did you understand death then?
Probably not. and again, this is in the Midwest in the early, early 80s. This was not exactly there wasn't a lot of therapy happening back then. I was given a book, literally given a book that said what to do when a parent dies, which I dutifully read, and it didn't really help. It was sort of like I would really rather just have my mom back than have to read about other kids that lost their parents. But no, it's a tough thing to take at that age, and I don't think I really got over that for quite some time.
Did anybody sit down and try to explain to you what death meant?
You know, there were sort of like these awkward conversations with my sisters or my dad or somebody. And so I would always kind of be like, I understand it. I get it. And then they would get super emotional because they obviously felt it at a, you know, super deep level. And so then I would just get bummed out that they got bummed out trying to explain to me the situation that sucked anyway. You know, I was kind of like, well, why are we even talking about this if it's going to make you sad and it's going to make me sad and it's going to make everybody sad? Like, we all kind of get it, right? Let's just move on. Which was probably not the most healthy attitude to have at 10. But, yeah, it's not fun. I don't wish it on anybody.
A lot of people start off in their path toward adulthood on the path that their parents want them to take, whether that means, you know, going to college when they didn't want to, or, you know, going into business when they'd prefer to be an artist, or, you know, whatever. But since you lost your mother when you were young and your father died when you were 20, when you were 20, you no longer had parents to either displease or please. so, like, they no longer had any say. And I'm wondering how that affected, if at all, your decision to give acting a shot, which is a very, very risky decision.
I'm sure it had some effect. I'm virtually certain, 100%, that had both my parents been around, I probably would have done something completely different with my life. But, you know, I think all performers come from a place of sort of self-doubt and pain and you know, Ray Romano said once very accurately and hilariously that if his dad would have spent more time with him, he probably would have become an accountant instead of a comedian. So I think that anybody that wants to get up on stage and tell jokes or do plays or sing songs has some sort of, at a fundamental level, desire to be paid attention to. And I am no different. But my mother, very, very early on, instilled in me an incredible desire to learn, and an incredible curiosity about the world, and an incredible joy in achieving things. And so that's probably the – and she also put me in creative writing classes and acting classes when I was a little kid, and encouraged me to do stuff. And so that's probably the biggest influence in what got me here.
What's the best school play you were ever in?
I can go from the Alpha to the Omega. The first school play, which was in many ways the best, was when I played Winnie the Pooh when I was in first grade at Robin Hill Elementary School, because I got the lead. I got to play Winnie the Pooh, and that was pretty great. But I think the most accomplished one was a production we did in college at the University of Missouri of Assassins, which is a Stephen Sondheim musical.
Oh, wow.
And
which assassin were you?
I played Leon Czolgosz, who assassinated President McKinley. And I recently saw the Broadway revival that they did, and I was kind of like, yeah, ours was as good as that, at least. I remember it very, very vividly, and we had an incredibly talented group of people. And we really, really loved it. And that was an incredibly fulfilling time I had on stage.
So when do we get to hear you sing? Maybe a revival of Guys and Dolls or something?
Now,
I could see
again,
you as Sky.
I don't know if what I do could be called singing. Sort of making noise in the right rhythm, perhaps, but... I was definitely the weak link vocally in that group of tremendous singers that we had in college. So probably no time soon, at least no time without a tremendous sense of irony.
In talking about singing, you did sing a couple of lines in the Emmys in that really funny opening number where everybody – it was kind of like a Glee tribute.
It was a little bit of a Glee tribute, yes. Jimmy asked me to be a part of that, and I had seen the one that they did on his show called 6B – where the cast of Parks and Recreation and the cast and writers of the Fallon Show did a very funny sort of sing off, so I knew that they had it in them, and I knew that they could do it. And that song, Born to Run, I can manage to do a passable Springsteen impression, I guess. So I was not asked to do a tremendous amount. I was asked to do just the right amount for me.
Well, John Hamm, thank you so much for talking with us. Good luck with your new film, The Town, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
John Hamm stars as Don Draper in the AMC series Mad Men, and he plays an FBI agent in the new Ben Affleck film, The Town, which opens this weekend. We're going to listen back to an interview with Edwin Newman, the former NBC News correspondent, anchor, and critic. He died of pneumonia last month at age 91, but his death wasn't announced until yesterday to give his family time to quietly grieve. Newman was also well known for his books and newspaper columns in which he did his best to defend the English language against what he perceived as pomposity, banality, grammatical offenses, and other abuses. I spoke with him in 1988, after the publication of his book, I Must Say, which collected the syndicated columns he'd written after retiring from NBC in 1984. He told me that his interest in language was encouraged when he was young.
A teacher told me, in fact, it was in junior high school, that I wrote well, and I believed her, which had a considerable effect on my life.
Were you already, when you were young, interested in uses and abuses of the English language? And did you ever correct friends who misspoke?
Yes, I did. Not always to the general delight of those I corrected, I must say. I also had to be careful at home about correcting anybody. For one thing, my parents did not have anything like the advantages that I did. Neither of them so much as graduated from high school. So it was necessary to be sensible about it, not to be overbearing about it, which I think is good advice for anyone, even today.
Now, you've written several best-selling books about our language, and I'd like to know how language and protecting the language became a serious interest of yours.
It had been a serious interest of mine for a very long time, as someone in the news business, because, after all, language is the instrument with which we work. Well, language and pictures, but certainly when I began, more language than pictures. And I thought that it was the business of anybody in the news business to, it was the part of anybody in the news business to examine what he was told or what she was told, and you cannot do that. You cannot examine what you're being told and judge its veracity unless you understand language, and particularly unless you understand when language is being used in an attempt to mislead you. I took that very seriously. That was a subject that was that I thought I had something to say about.
Now, I've read that you used to keep files of bad writing that you'd come across at work. is that right?
It is true. My editor, a woman named Jeanette Hopkins, said to me, just collect some envelopes. Mark one with the name of a particular subject, sports, let's say. Another one, news. Another one, government language, and so on and so on. And collect clippings. I was amazed at how quickly the clippings piled up.
Did you keep these files hidden from your colleagues? I'd hate to think what would happen if one of your colleagues found their copy in your file.
I kept the files at home, but I did a lot of work on the book in the office, did a lot of writing in the office. But I was tactful. Tactful and careful about what I did. People used to kid me a great deal and tell me they didn't want to say anything in my presence. And they were very careful about what they were writing because they didn't want to wind up in one of my books or perhaps in one of the essays I was doing on the air. I did a number of essays on the air on the subject before even the first book came out. And I had written a good many articles, magazine articles, The Atlantic, Harper's, New York Times Magazine, and some others, on this subject. So that even before the books came out, people knew of my interest.
What was your reaction the first time you saw yourself on TV?
I was very pleased. Perhaps I shouldn't admit that, but I was pleased, and I thought, well, this is something I can do.
You were on television during several key historical moments. Didn't you have to anchor the special bulletins or the continuing coverage after the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy?
Yes, I did. I became the person at NBC for many years who dealt with emergencies, was called in when something usually dreadful of that kind had happened. And I began with the shooting of President Kennedy. I announced President Kennedy's death, but on the radio, and then went to Washington and did both radio and television. But when Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, yes, it seemed to me I was on the air for days. The same was true with Robert Kennedy, and then I did that again with George Wallace, did it again with the shooting of Ronald Reagan.
Let me ask you about the first time when you had to announce John Kennedy's assassination on the radio. When you're dealing with something tragic like that and you have to announce it, there are two considerations in how you're going to speak. One is basically uncontrollable. I mean, how do you feel and how is that going to, in spite of yourself, get expressed in your voice? And the other is what kind of tone do you consciously want to strive for in your announcement of this terrible event? What tone of voice did you use when you announced Kennedy's assassination?
I have heard myself... I've heard recordings of myself announcing the president's death, and obviously my voice was grave and it was somber. And it was not necessary to put that on. That's how you felt. In fact, as you sat there dealing with this information, you couldn't help asking yourself, is this really happening? Then, because you are in the news business, you say to yourself, in effect, well, if this is really happening, I'm glad I'm the one they've chosen to deal with it. In a way, it's a mark of confidence, but also because you understand that you have to bring a certain degree of detachment to it. Now, not everybody can do that, and if not everybody can do that, that's easily understandable. But clearly, if you're a human being, you're going to be affected by it, and that will show in your voice. It seems to me you do not try for it.
Journalist Edwin Newman recorded in 1988. His death was announced yesterday. He was 91. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.